You're listening to Trek FM.
Hi, welcome to Commentary Trek Stars, T-R-E-K. Write it down. Where we talk about Star Trek people, that i.e. writers, producers, and creators, and their work outside of Star Trek, because if we talked about Star Trek all the time, we'd be in high school. This is going to be part one of our sequence of episodes, our Nicholas Meyer arc.
Specifically, Nicholas Meyer as an author.
As an author of books. That's things on paper. I suppose you could have them on iPads and whatnot nowadays.
I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today we are going to kick this off with an introduction to Nicholas Meyer by looking at his work in Star Trek. Really only three things.
Yes.
But they're three amazing things. Two amazing things and one really good thing. Okay, well, let's jump into the first thing.
Let's jump into that first thing.
Nicholas Meyer.
I think we should start with Harve Bennett.
Okay, Harve Bennett. What do you want to talk about Harve Bennett?
Harve Bennett opened the door for Nicholas Meyer.
Harve Bennett did open the door for Nicholas Meyer. Harve Bennett was brought in as producer of the Star Trek movie series after Star Trek the Motion Picture failed to
be a movie.
Yeah, wow audiences in the way that some had hoped.
I think it wowed Star Trek fans.
Okay.
But the problem was that there were not enough of those.
Right.
Which they should have been well aware of because of the whole it being canceled thing.
Yeah. Now, you just read the Nicholas Meyer memoir.
Yeah.
A View to the Bridge.
Well,
view
just like
of
2 weeks
from
ago.
The bridge. A View from the Bridge. So it'll be fresh in your mind. But am I right in thinking, correct me if I'm wrong, am I right in thinking that basically Meyer, who was a novelist to begin with, he had made time after time and was trying to, you know, get his foot a little bit further into the door of filmmaking and having a good relationship, you know, with someone at Paramount or what mm-hmm. have you. They suggested that he try to take a shot at Star Trek II.
Yeah, for the most part.
And the problem was that there were a lot of ideas for Star Trek II, which worked as ideas, but not as a full movie. And Nicholas Meyer volunteered, essentially, to take those ideas and fuse them into one screenplay, which is Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
Uncredited. But based on that, the strength of that screenplay, he not only did the movie get made, but it got made by him. He directed it.
Mm-hmm. There were some interesting sort of, you know, like mechanics behind this that that the book doesn't really go into, because there, you know, it's always sort of we have an understanding that behind the scenes of you know, credits and producerial credits and of a given person being selected to do a movie, there's a whole bunch of stuff that doesn't come to light, and the book sort of it sort of skims around issues that we've heard more about outside of it, and I imagine that's probably just because Nicholas Meyer was probably not present for a lot of those wheelings and dealings and political assassinations.
But you know, whatever the reasons may be, the end result was Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. First off, for those who don't know, what are your thoughts on Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan?
It's all right.
It's all right. Just good. It's kind of good. Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's probably the most succinct representation of everything Roddenberry was trying to do.
I can see that in a certain way.
And it kind of it's basically a perfect primer on like the general sort of Star Trek world, and by world I mean universe or whatever. Continuity, and it does sort of resolve a lot of basic sort of storytelling problems that the series had, and it introduces a lot of really amazing ideas. And I think that a lot of the brilliance behind Star Trek II was in the crazy ideas that Meyer had to make sense of.
Mm-hmm.
And Meyer's sort of mutant power was to see the merit of ideas and not be blinded by the requirements of those ideas. And like, you know, the Genesis device and Khan, Noonien, and Singh and, you know, Kirk growing old. These are weird sort of loaded things. And Meyer was able to, you know, essentially, you know, like a wizard, just see that they were all consistent if you looked at them a certain way, which is really a brilliant thing. The idea that he was able to see these story elements and not be screwed up by the requirements of those stories.
Well, I mean, I think that the fact that Star Trek II was made by a bunch of non-Star Trek people really helped to give the franchise a different perspective, which allowed them to sort of look at what it actually is. You know, I mean, when you have like such a myopic point of view for the span of 15 years or something like that, you have a tendency to lose sight of what it is that you actually are trying to do. And when someone else comes in and says, wait, I just watched these episodes, I know what you're trying to do, and you can't see the forest through the trees right now, you know, let me take a stab at it and try to make it into something that you are trying to make it into.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what
that's the mechanism that most things try to use to stay in touch with the core.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of why, you know, franchises on a regular basis do that kind of thing, and it's why studios have actually sort of incorporated the idea of fresh eyes into almost everything, to the point of absurdity. To the point where, like, you know, screenwriters are hired on a regular basis to replace a previous one in order to have fresh eyes on the project.
Well, that's a problem, you know, usually more. I think that the fresh eyes should come in more along the lines of what Pixar does, you know, where you have, like, you know, their think tank or whatever they call it.
Yeah, the problem is the fresh eyes concept is sort of fundamentally flawed. I mean, it's got merits to it. But it's not a tool that you can use infinitely. I mean, it's a resource, and the fact is, like, once you use it two or three times, it doesn't have any power anymore.
Well, it's a resource, like you're saying. I mean, they shouldn't hire someone else to come in with fresh eyes to completely, you know, redo everything. But if you have someone come in and say, "Hey, I think I see what you're trying to do, and maybe you should do it this way," then you'd be like, "Oh yeah, okay, now I see where the problem lies," and this is why the prequels are what they are. You know, there were no fresh eyes, no checks and balances. You see that kind of thing.
The prequels. The problem with the prequels is not going to be solved with fresh eyes.
It's
let's use fresh eyes more. And this is a term I want to stick around for another 20 years.
Okay, so yeah, Star Trek II. You know. To me, it's a very amazing movie. I mean, to me, it did exactly what it set out to do. For me personally, like, it got me interested. It got me hooked on Star Trek after seeing the motion picture and being like, this is crap, you know? I mean, like, I think I talked about it, you know, earlier in the start of our Roddenberry thing, but, you know, watch the motion picture, first Star Trek I ever saw, really didn't like it at all. Was persuaded to watch Star Trek II by my friend Matt and fell in love with the entire franchise. And here we are today talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this on the commentary for the motion picture.
Yeah.
But I grew up with Star Trek as part of my life. It was in I recently learned that my timeline for my very early childhood is wrong. That I was actually I was actually taken out of the country when I was 6 months old. And somehow I already knew what Star Trek was by that point. So I don't know how that's possible, but somehow it's true. And like, by the time I saw the motion picture, I was, you know, like 6 years old or something. I might have been five. I don't know. But I loved that thing. And I didn't have any questions about its dramatic power. I just loved it. Just loved it. And when I saw Star Trek II, freaked me out. Because it was violent. And people died. It's dark.
Well, that's true. I actually remember as a little kid being over at Benny's house. And his sister, I think, was watching Star Trek II on HBO.
And then you watched RoboCop.
Yeah, and then I watched RoboCop. And I'm like, oh, my God. No, that was a few years later. But I remember seeing Star Trek II on the screen and being like, ooh, it's space stuff mm-hmm. and there's Star in it. That must mean it's like Star Wars. And then seeing, you know, Khan, and I don't think I saw the part with the, you know,
the worm,
but, it was certainly something which I was aware of.
The last indigenous species of Celti Alpha 5.
Yeah. And I, you know, that was another thing, you know, like, that had been built up so much that, like, I was like, I'm a little scared. Like, yeah. We're talking to Matt, you know, and this is, I mean, just so everyone knows, I was 12 years old when this happened. And I'm like, I'm a little scared of, you know, the thing. I don't know if I want to see that, you know, maybe I'll close my eyes and you tell me when it's over with, whatever. Yeah. You know, which I think I did, because it is kind of freaky. But what can you do?
See, the word never freaked me out. What freaked me out was sort of like the horror of Khan's anger.
Oh yeah,
he was just so apocalyptically mad. It was just like watching that guy. It was like, are people really like this? My horror as a child was always the result of like, oh my god, that guy's psycho. I am afraid of people like that.
Did you think he was like a one-man weapon of mass destruction who can detonate the fleet and all it stands for?
Maybe devastate the fleet?
Not detonate.
But detonate the fleet? That's not even a sentence.
Yeah. I mean, Khan is really... And that's the one thing which, you know, whenever I think about it, I almost wish it wasn't Khan, because then you have it tied to Space Seed. And... like, one thing that I remember hearing, you know, back when I was in high school working at a comic book store, I was talking to one of the guys who works there, and he was like...
in high school, at a comic book store, talking about Star Trek, those are some badass virgins.
and this guy, Shirley, that's not his real name.
Oh my god! Don't call him Shirley!
He had a really interesting point, you know, which was basically like, he put it in comic book terms, you know, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan is sort of like Star Trek number zero. You know, it is a perfect introductory issue to Star Trek, you know. Mm-hmm. It tells you who all the characters are, what their relationships are. It sets up the entire world. It's a good example of what Star Trek is, you know, on sort of like a quintessential level, but also at its best. You know, it is like the perfect thing to show someone and say, you want to know what Star Trek is? This is Star Trek.
That's what I just said.
Right. But, and I always thought that made a lot of sense. The one thing which bothers me is the fact that there is this history with mm-hmm. Khan, you know?
Oh, but that's actually the perfect thing.
Okay. Explain to me why.
History.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have always approached things in a certain way, and I often approach things from the same perspective, but I have at times realized that there is something very important about not having access to everything. And the idea that Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, has a history that actually exists. You can, you know, watch the episodes and see how it occurred. That is actually very important, because as a series, Star Trek has been going for a very, very, very long time. And you can say, hey, they're restarting the franchise, but at the same time, they're also not. They're also continuing the franchise. And I don't think that you would say to somebody, hey, have you seen Star Trek 09? Oh, you should have watched the past 40 years before seeing that.
No.
Right, because in a sense, ideally, we should be able to join in at any time.
Yeah, and that's a good jumping on point.
Right, I mean, there are lots of good jumping on points. I mean, my feeling is that like, one of my favorite things is to jump onto something that I don't really know and then get excited about it. And a long time ago, I realized that I can take a boring book and make it much more interesting to me by skipping the first three pages.
Yeah, you've said that you never read the first three pages.
Well, no, I know I never start with the first three pages.
Okay.
Like, if I'm not anticipating liking a book, I skip the first three pages and just start from there. If I really like the book, I'll just start and just get all the way through, and there's no problem. But it's sort of about, you know, making a challenge for me that is different. Because if I'm sitting there reading it like the normal book, I'm bored. But if I make a problem by have some information that's lost, then I'm playing with the material as I go through it, and that's an important thing for watching any sort of thing that's been around for longer than you. And Star Trek's been around for a lot longer than any of us, and longer than most of the people I know who are aware of Star Trek. Yeah. I know, like, 3 Star Trek fans who were around when Star Trek began. And the idea that there should be a history, some of which is not accessible, I think is important. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah,
that there's a history that could be lost. So the idea that the quintessential Star Trek would include references to a history that is not seen, that's perfect.
Okay, I guess I can kind of see that. I guess the completist in me, you know, wants to have it all, you know, work. But then again...
And I have pointed out that as human beings, we have the ability of discretion, which means that we don't have to be completists because the idea of completion is insane. We can never completely understand everything.
Well, maybe, yeah. But then again, you know, like, I did... That was the second Star Trek thing that I saw, and I wasn't lost. I mean, I knew that Khan was on an episode prior,
mm-hmm.
but it had been, you know, probably about a year until I actually seen Space Seed. And, you know... You don't really have to watch it to understand what's going on. Well, after Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and the success of that, you know, Nicholas Meyer was offered the chance to direct Star Trek III, and he turned it down.
That's a very good move for Nicholas Meyer, a very bad move for Star Trek in general, because that was the beginning of the end of quality.
Okay. Well, his reason for turning it down was that he couldn't be associated with a story involving resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't believe in it. He thought it was cheap.
And I would like to point something out here. Okay, this is a guy who made Star Trek II. He made a bunch of money on it. And they said, we're going to bring Spock back. And he said, I don't want to be involved. This is not a guy who made a decision arbitrarily. This is a guy who had a very significant problem with this story.
Mm-hmm.
He was opposed to this story. He said, I don't want to be involved in that. I don't want my name attached to something like that.
Yeah.
That's a very big deal. I mean, like it's not really talked about, but it seems very clear that Nicholas Meyer said, that is unbelievably stupid. I want nothing to do with it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's exactly what he said.
No, but like in a very angry tone, possibly with a lot of swearing.
Well, yeah, I mean, like even the last shot of the movie where you see Spock's burial tube on the surface.
Yeah.
He said that, you know, that was something which was added after the fact.
I think that he has always been, and it's in the book, he's very polite about it,
mm-hmm.
okay? I don't think that he was polite to the people involved.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't polite about it back then. He was so unpolite that when they said, do this, he was like, no, you're going to have to do it yourselves.
Right, and I'd like to point out that he was completely right. Their desire to do Star Trek III was fundamentally wrong, and un-Roddenberry-esque. And then, to compound those problems of you know, denying the sacrifice of the previous film, denying the basic dramatic structure of the previous movie, and you know, essentially this is the prototype for killing Newton Hicks, invalidating the movie that just came before you. Star Trek III then proceeds to eliminate the statement behind the Genesis device. These are all very humongous things. And Nicholas Meyer not being involved with Star Trek III is possibly what allowed people who shouldn't have been involved in the creative process of a Star Trek story to begin with to screw things up.
Yeah, I mean, that could be.
And I am not entirely certain where I fall on the issue of, like, should Nicholas Meyer have remained involved? Because the fact is that Spock's resurrection is fairly insignificant compared to the Genesis device thing.
Yeah. Well, that's what he seemed to have the biggest problem with, was Spock's resurrection. And he said that he could come back after Spock was resurrected. He just couldn't be involved with that story itself. And he did come back immediately after Spock was resurrected. He was a writer on Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home.
Which is somehow still not entirely known.
Yes, I just had a debate about this on Twitter last night with David Mack, who is a Star Trek writer himself.
Yeah, and he was talking about
like Time After Time.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh man, it's amazing.
I saw that, and I was like, really? He doesn't know that those are similar things?
Yeah, I mean, like he was like, well, what's the? I don't see any similarities.
Oh well, you know, I mean, they do start around 45 like, minutes in,
or you know, he said the plot seems to be, you know, different. I don't see any similarities in the plot. And I'm like, well,
it's true.
The tone.
He goes in a different direction.
The tone, the gags, you know. I'm like, and it's been a while since I've seen Time After Time, so I couldn't cite specific examples. But I remember watching Time After Time and going like.
There's the antique shop.
Oh, my God. The antique shop? Okay. Yeah, that's what I kind of thought. You know,
the antique shop scene is super weird because it's basically the same scene.
Okay, yeah.
And like, that's.
I'll have to watch it again and
yeah.
And,
it like and the, do the important thing here is that if you don't see a tonal connection between Time After Time and Star Trek IV,
he was like, well, tone. It seems he's like it seems weird to criticize a writer for having similar tone.
Who's criticizing?
That's what I said. I'm not criticizing. You know, I like both movies quite a bit. I just thought it was really weird that he did like the same thing twice.
Right, but I mean, if your story involves going through time traveling to. What is now?
Yeah.
That's going to be funny.
Especially now San Francisco. You know, it was even the same
Well, where else
city.
Are you going to go?
Meyer, I read last night, was actually worried about the similarities. And he almost turned down the job. And then when he decided to take the job, he asked them to change the city in Star Trek IV to Paris. So yeah, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, he didn't direct. But he wrote, specifically, he wrote the 1986 sequences.
Right. But, I mean, he wrote them in the sense that, you know, he crossed out the names from the Time After Time script and then had it FedExed over to the people making Star Trek IV.
Okay, yeah. But regardless, you know, it's...
Very similar scenes.
it's interesting, you know, like, because if you look at that movie, there is a lot of stuff in the 23rd century, a lot more than I had than you think about.
Star Trek IV?
Yeah. But the stuff inside the... I mean, you can almost see how you could get Harve Bennett, I think it was, to write the bookend scenes and have Nicholas Meyer himself write the stuff in, you know, 86, because it does have its own little internal arc during that time period.
Which is sort of a problem.
Maybe.
I mean, like, ultimately, the big dramatic problem with Star Trek IV is that nobody remembers the drama.
Yeah. And just remember the little funny bits.
Yeah, and I think that's because they were written by different people. Maybe. Like, the future sequences are like, Earth is in a lot of peril. We're all going to die. What time is it? It's like 4:30. We'll be dead by 5. Just FYI, Kirk. We're all going to be dead within half an hour. And Kirk's like, I know. Let's go back in time to San Francisco and get some whales so that we can save them from being killed in the next 25 minutes. And then they get there and they're like, well, now that we're back in time, we got plenty of time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've got a time machine. We've got a spaceship, which begs the question, why didn't we just do this a lot more leisurely? Why don't we do this all the time? This really begs a lot of questions, Spock. Spock, run some numbers for me. How come we don't time travel all the time?
Well, they talk about how it's hard to do.
It's stupid.
Okay.
Go counterclockwise around the sun. You're back in time. Go clockwise. You're going forward in time. Don't get me started on clocks, you guys.
After writing Star Trek IV, they
after
brought...
Writing.
After writing
in quotation marks.
Star Trek IV, after doing a
find and replace,
find and replace on Star Trek IV, he was brought back again on Star Trek VI, this time to direct and write,
yeah.
And I know that there's a bit of, you know, crazy history with that, you know, them hiring other writers and, you know, knowing that they need to get him on and knowing that they might need to offer him a directing job in order to do so and all that other stuff. It actually seems very similar to the process which they went through on Star Trek II. They were under very strict time constraints because they needed to get it out for the 25th anniversary and all this other stuff. And
well, I mean, there's a thing in Hollywood. It's sort of an interesting paradigm that they seem to have going on there all the time. They bring people come in and do things and change things, and people get paid to do various projects. And I mean, like, how many movies have never been made that have been in production for like a decade?
Well, sure,
it happens all the time. And it seems that Star Trek has suffered from some of those, you know, production problems, because it's not exactly the same thing as Star Wars, where, you know, one guy is sort of pulling the trigger and making these things happen. Roddenberry did sort of share responsibility with Paramount, which meant that on occasion, Paramount would go crazy. pay one guy, that guy comes in, changes a bunch of things, and then that guy says, like, I don't know what to do about this thing, and they bring in two people, and those people hire three more people, and then those three more people hire one guy. And then eventually everybody just goes, like, all right, let's just call Nicholas Meyer, he'll make a movie out of this.
What do you think about Star Trek VI in general?
Oh, for a long time it was my favorite of the movies. And I had to, coming to terms with the idea that Star Trek II was better was actually sort of an emotional process, because I had to face up to the idea that I was liking Star Trek VI for purely fan reasons, and that I wasn't open to the idea that Star Trek II was better on film reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But Star Trek VI is fantastic. It's the movie that I point to when people say Star Trek is really good about doing social commentary. And I say, Star Trek is really good about doing social commentary, but in the way that science fiction is good about it. And that it might be about things that are happening now, but it doesn't have to be burdened by those realities. Star Trek VI is not an allegory for the fall of the Soviet Union. It's a movie that uses that as inspiration to talk about collapse in general, about transitional phases between cultures. It's a difficult, mechanism, and you can't look at it purely like a clock. These are big systems interacting.
Yeah. It's
brilliantly executed for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, dramatically speaking, it's got some problems.
Not that many. I mean, there's certainly movies which have more problems than
that. Oh, yeah. No, no question.
I mean, I think
it's still great. It's just not as good as 2.
I don't know. I think it actually is better than 2. I think aside from the J.J. Abrams movie, it's my favorite. In addition to everything that you said, it also feels like a great finale for the original series, which is something that it never had, back when it was a TV show or anything like that. I mean, Star Trek II, I guess, could have worked that way as well. But Star Trek VI, I think, is a really good final episode, in a sense. And I really appreciate it for that. I also think that...
you also like the way that they fly into the sun?
Yeah. I also think that the just production value on Star Trek VI is extremely high caliber. I like the fact that it wasn't trying to be a Star Trek movie so much as just being a good movie. I really love the music.
Star Trek VI is Star Trek VI is incredibly well done.
Yeah,
it's just it's not perfect.
Well, I mean, what is
2?
So that's Meyer's entire history in
Star Trek 2 and Die Hard.
Those two movies,
those two movies are perfect.
But I mean, he only made those three movies in Star Trek, 2, 4, and 6.
Yeah.
I mean, he is, in essence, responsible for the even-numbered rule, right?
You could say that he is the actual distinction between the odd and the even movies.
Yeah.
And you could say that because there's a correlation, there's a causation, but that ain't scientific. The causal relationship is clear. That Nicholas Meyer's involvement makes movies better, but Nicholas Meyer's involvement is not necessarily limited to even-numbered movies.
That could be.
I think it's entirely possible that somebody could hire Nicholas Meyer to make a movie that was an odd-numbered one in a series.
We may never know that, but I mean that's quite possible.
I think that it should be somebody should try it. Somebody try to get Nicholas Meyer involved in something that's an odd-numbered film. We should hire him for the next Star Trek movie.
Okay, all right.
After Into Darkness, when they do the search for Spock, but again, kind of in a way, sort of, you guys, in parentheses, all that's in parentheses. We should get him in on that. Where it's not a resurrection. It's just a really long behind-the-scenes process where they recast Spock.
Okay, all right.
That's a fantastic idea. I want to see that. The feature film about casting Zachary Quinto, The Search for Spock.
Hey, someone could do it.
If anybody could do it, it's Nicholas Meyer.
Nicholas Meyer.
That guy knows how to make a good Star Trek movie.
Yeah, you're right. I'd watch it. I'd watch it twice.
Kirk and Bones get transported into the real world, and they have to make Star Trek in order to go back into that universe.
Mm-hmm. They go into an antique shop.
Yeah.
They say like, Leonard Nimoy.
How much can I get for these original Star Trek props? And then the guy's like, whoa, not much here because I'm not a nerd, but I know a guy. And then, yeah, this is a solid plot for a movie. All right, I'm going to get on that.
So any final thoughts on Nicholas Meyer as a Star Trek writer-director?
As a Star Trek writer and director, we all know we love this guy's work. We want to see him do more things, and it's unfortunate that he's, you know, a single human being, that he has corporeal limitations, that he can only be in one place at one time, and that, you know, he has a lifespan. I think that we should get on this whole cloning thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get just start making another one of him, because when he does, we might not have anyone left that knows how to make a good, smart Star Trek movie.
Well, I don't think that that's true, but, you know, certainly he is up there as far as Star Trek movie creators are concerned, as far as Star Trek creators are concerned. And we're going to be looking at his novels. We are doing Target Practice, The 7% Solution, The West End Horror, Black Orchid, Confessions of a Homing Pigeon, and The Canary Trainer.
He likes birds.
So we are going to be looking forward to that. Next week we've got Target Practice, his first book.
After that one, it's going to get good.
Okay.
Because that one is not super good.
I'm looking forward to Target Practice. Haven't read it yet. I'm looking forward to it. And we've got some really cool guests lined up, and I'm not going to say who, just in case anything falls through. But, yeah, we've got some people, some experts in various fields, some literary fans and what have you. And I think that that this will be a good little series. And then we'll take a break
from it.
Good
little series.
Good little series.
Don't say a good little series.
Okay.
Say this is going to be a great, awesome, magnificent, humongous, engorged, thick, long series.
And then we'll take a break, do a couple of other things, and later on we will come back and look at Nicholas Meyer's movies. So that's the plan. As always, you can find us at our other show on CommentaryTrackStars.com. It's called Commentary Track Stars. You can find audio commentaries for Star Trek 2, 4, and 6 on there if you want to hear what we have to think about Nicholas Meyer's work on Star Trek in depth. And you can also follow us on Twitter at ComTrackStars or email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. So many things. So many things. So there you go. Thanks for listening. And we will be back next time with Target Practice.
Target Practice!